Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, the case of the United States government's genocide of indigenous Americans. My guest, Danny Sheehan. Danny will be broadcasting with us from Santa Cruz. Danny is one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. During the past 45 years, he has handled such public interest cases as the Pentagon Papers, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, and the Karen Silkwood murder case. He has represented victims of the Three Mile Island nuclear disaster and fought against the American Nazi Party on hate crimes. He is the founder of the Christic Institute and the Romero Institute. They're both nonprofits. Danny has his law degree from Harvard University and later returned to study at the Harvard Divinity School. He is the author of The People's Advocate, and his websites are Daniel I.P. Sheehan, SSHEEHAN.com, and RomeroInstitute.org. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
Terrific, Gary. I'm glad to be here. It's a sad subject, but it's an important one.
Yes, it is. I'd like to share some quotes from Tanya Lee in Truthout, entitled The Native American Genocide and the Teaching of U.S. History. She says, when the term genocide is uttered in mainstream school environments, it's usually referring to the Jewish Holocaust or to other genocides committed in the 20th century, Turkey, Stalin's Russia, Nanking, Cambodia, Rwanda, Bosnia-Herzegovina. But in many U.S. classrooms, the U.S. has left out the list of any genocides that has occurred in America. And so when the College Board decided in 2012 that high school students taking advanced placement U.S. History should learn about the American Indian genocide and other events in our history that did not support the notion that ours is a country that where peace, justice, and so-called American way have always prevailed, the uproar could be heard from Texas to Georgia, from Colorado to North Carolina. The Republican National Committee passed a resolution in August 2014 asking for a congressional investigation into this study and stating, quote, the framework curriculum of what students should learn about U.S. history courses presents a biased and inaccurate view of many important events in American history, including the motivations and actions of 17th through 19th century settlers. Well, state legislators have joined county school boards in condemning the exam that teaches about American genocide. They don't want us talking about the Indian genocide, and that's where it stands. So we are a nation that is supposed to be exceptional. That is the precept, that the United States is unique and quantitatively superior to other nations because it was founded based on democratic principles, Christian values, and personal liberty. The concept in popular culture translates to America being somehow superior, more fair, more just, more moral, more accepted in the eyes of God than any other group. But as Julia Goodfox, who is a Pawnee and the interim dean of natural and social sciences at Haskell, Indiana University, explains, American exceptionalism is a particularly political culture ideology that's been used to construct a particular type of nationalism or a particular type of U.S. identity. American exceptionalism, constructed to justify anti-Indian policies, particularly during the 19th century. And so it goes. Then I thought I would just let people know that the United States government has signed more than 500 treaties with Native American tribes. That's an awful lot of treaties. So how many of those have we kept? How about none? We have broken more than 500 treaties and still continue to do so. Just today, Danny, I was looking on my website and saw that there are at least two states, Montana and North Dakota, where pipelines are going through their property and their sacred grounds, and the United States government is supporting those, the builders of the pipelines, and not supporting the Native Americans' treaties or the rights of their own land. So you have to understand, what does it look like from the Native American point of view? And then you start saying, wow, this has been going on for a long time. In fact, in 1851, Fort Laramie Treaty identified boundaries owned by the Lakota people and the United States government. Well, what happened if you put those together? That would have meant that Lakota would have had a property about twice the size of Oklahoma. That's a pretty good piece of land. But Abraham Lincoln allowed an enormous amount of Americans to go settle on native lands. That was the Homestead Act. And as a result, the Indians were angry and they fought back. And they had what was called an uprising in 1863 by the Santee Sioux in Minnesota. So what did Abraham Lincoln do? Well, he caused the largest mass hanging in U.S. history. They rounded up 38 Sioux leaders, and under the specific and direct orders of President Abraham Lincoln, they executed him. And 2 days later, Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. So clearly, when we look at some of our leaders, we should be looking at what they really represented in their ideals. But let me tell you about a few of our leaders before we get to you, Danny. George Washington, the first president of the United States, head of the Continental Army, who helped secure our freedom from Great Britain. Quote, "Indians and wolves are both beasts of prey, though they differ in shape." How about Thomas Jefferson? Quote, If ever we were constrained to lift a hatchet against any tribe, we will never lay it down till the tribe is exterminated or driven beyond the Mississippi in war. They will kill some of us, we shall destroy them all. And how about one of the most rabid, rampant racists in the history of American presidency, Andrew Jackson? Quote, "My original convictions upon this subject have been confirmed by the course of events for several years, and experience is every day adding to their strength, that those tribes cannot exist surrounded by our settlements and in continual contact with our citizens is certain. They have neither the intelligence, the industry, the moral habits, nor the desire of improvement which are essential to any favorable change in their condition. Established in the midst of another and a superior race, and without appreciating the causes of their inferiority or seeking to control them, they must necessarily yield to the force of circumstances and disappear." He also said, in fact, it was President Lincoln who said to General Sibley, ordering the execution, that Indians and half-breeds sentenced to be hanged by the military commission and were not fit. And then you had Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt. "I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of 10 are, and I shouldn't like to inquire too closely into the case of the 10th. Fair enough. That's their feelings. And one of the things that was very specific was that they have no deep consciousness. They have no, quote, neither intelligence, the industry or moral habits, or the desire to improve. Okay, that's one side of it. But how about Luther Standing Bear, Lakota Sioux, who said, "I'm going to venture that the man who sat on the ground in his teepee meditating on life and its meaning, accepting the kinships of all creatures and acknowledging unity with the universe of things, was infusing into his being the true essence of civilization." And how about a Comanche, Quinana Parker? "The white man goes into his church and talks about Jesus. The Indian goes into his teepee and talks with Jesus." And how about the Lakota Sioux, Lame Deer? "Before our white brothers arrived to make us civilized men, we didn't have any kind of prisons. Because of this, we had no delinquents. Without a prison, there can be no delinquents. We had no locks nor keys, and therefore among us there were no thieves. When someone was so poor he couldn't afford a horse or a tent or a blanket, he would in that case receive it all as a gift. We were too uncivilized to give great importance to civilized property. We didn't know any kind of money, and consequently the value of a human being was not determined by his wealth. We had no written laws laid down, no lawyers, no politicians. Therefore, we were not able to cheat and swindle one another. We were really in bad shape before the white men arrived, and I don't know how to explain how we were able to manage these fundamentals before they arrived. And one of the most famous Indians was Chief Seattle. In 1866, he said, "Humankind has not woven the web of life. We are but one thread within it. Whatever we do to the web, we do ourselves. All things are bound together, all things connected." And how about Red Cloud, Lakota? "I am poor and naked, but I am the chief of the nation. We do not want riches. We do not want to train our children right. Riches would not do us any good. We cannot take them with us to the other world. We do not want riches. We want peace and love." Or how about Black Elk, the Lakota Sioux? "Out of the Indian approach to life, there came a great freedom, an intense and absorbing respect for life, enriching faith in the supreme power, and the principles of truth, honesty, generosity, equality, and the brotherhood as a guide to mundane relations." And also from Black Elk, "Grown men can learn very little except from the heart, and once they learn from the heart, it is pure. Therefore, the Great Spirit may show to them many things which some older people may miss." And also, one final one, when you look at how uncivilized they are, remember this. From Cree prophecy, "When all the trees have been cut down, when all the animals have been hunted, when all the waters polluted, when all the air is unsafe to breathe, only then will you discover you cannot eat money." Now, I give that as a background to open our program because we have to always look at the historical context. So, Danny, with that said, we have some important news to begin our program, and when we consider that between 50 to 100 million indigenous people lived in the United States by the time the Europeans arrived, it was not an uncivilized place. The history of the United States is really history of settled colonization of land, and free land was the magnet that attracted thousands of Europeans to our shores. And people have always fought against colonizers. People don't simply hand over their land, their resources, their children, and their futures without a fight. And Native American struggles were met with violence by the early U.S. government. The British, to their credit, in 1763 had a proclamation that made gobbling up Indian land west of the Appalachians and the Allegheny Mountains illegal. It was under British protection. But the Continental Congress, under President Jefferson in 1801, destroyed that proclamation and made all the land west of those ranges a free for all, anyone who wanted to settle it. And much of this fell under what was called the Doctrine of Discovery. Still a law of the land, although it goes back to the 16th century, with mandating European colonization of foreign lands. And in 2012, a UN session focused on the rights of indigenous people was devoted to this doctrine of discovery, yet no one knows about it. So, Danny, what constitutes genocide? Was U.S. government expansion and taking over native lands simply a removal of individuals, and in which case not a genocide, or was it in the extermination of peoples, which is a genocide?
No, it was definitely a genocide. In fact, as recently as 2015, the Canadian government undertook a major study pursuant to a Truth and Reconciliation Commission decree, and determined that the Canadian government had in fact copied the exact program that had been instituted in the United States in the 1860s, and that they determined that the Canadian construction of Indian boarding schools was specifically designed to exterminate the indigenous people of Canada. That they wanted to exterminate them. They wanted to totally eliminate their culture. So they seized their children and mandated that they be placed in these Indian boarding schools where they were forbidden to speak their language or they were beaten. Their hair was cut off. And they were given Christian names, and that they were tried to eliminate their Indianness. And they copied the American doctrine of, you know, to save the child, you have to kill the Indian in them. And they acknowledged that it had been done specifically because the Canadian government wanted to be able to take their land away. And once they had taken their land away, they did not want to have to pay the Indian people any of the goods and services that they had promised by treaty to give to them. So that if they could eliminate the tribes and eliminate them as a people, they would then not have to pay those reparations for having taken their land. And that's identical to what the American government had done. And they explicitly acknowledged in their Truth and Reconciliation Commission report that they had expressly copied the whole program from the United States. So one of the things that the Lakota People's Law Office in Rapid City, South Dakota, which I'm the chief counsel for, has been calling for is to try to get the next incoming president to establish a Truth and Reconciliation Commission pertaining to the Native American people. And this is something that I've been working on for many years now. I first had my engagement. This is peculiar because I was born up in Lake George, New York, just a few miles south of the Six Indian Nation Confederacy. This is the Iroquois Confederacy, with the Iroquois and the Onondaga and the Mohawk and the Seneca. They have lived up in that region of northern New York and southern Canada for over 2,000 years. And they have lived in harmony for 1,000 of those years by having established the Akwesasne, which is the Great White Roots of Peace, where they bring their medicine people together to sit in council and to do a native ceremony pursuant to which they solve all of their problems together. And it turns out that region of the North America has never ever been part of the United States or Canada. It actually exists as a completely independent region pursuant to a treaty that was signed between the then Five Indian Nation Confederacy by Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton, who actually signed the treaty with them, acknowledging the complete independence of that territory because they did not want those people to join with the French in the French and Indian Wars against the colonies. So that is existed. And I grew up there in an all-white community north of Lake George and never even realized that it was there. I just thought that it was part of the Adirondack Forest Preserve and the Syracuse Forest Preserve. But it's all Native American territory. And it wasn't until, you know, I had already graduated from Harvard Law School and was at Attorney F. Lee Bailey's office in 1972 and 1973 when the Wounded Knee occupation occurred in early 1973. And I was contacted sort of on an emergency basis by one of my Harvard Law School classmates and a good friend of mine, Joseph Durem, who had become chief counsel for the Native American Rights Committee for the American Civil Liberties Union. And he had been called in out of the Rocky Mountain Regional Office of ACLU to help the Native people that were surrounded by the military troops, tanks, and armored personnel carriers of the Nixon administration that had been called in by the Assistant Attorney General of South Dakota, William Jenklow, surrounded them and had sharpshooters attempting to kill them because they had occupied a town on within their own reservation, even their own Pine Ridge Reservation. They occupied this little village, and they had tried to order a white store owner to leave their reservation. And the white attorney general, William Jenklow, called in the Nixon administration, and they encircled them and started shooting at them with sharpshooters to stop them. And I was called in to come in to help, because I had had a number of years of trial experience at the Cahill Gordon firm on Wall Street and then at F. Lee Bailey's office. And Joe Durham had not had any trial experience yet, so he called me in to help. And I ended up becoming legal counsel for the Native American Rights Committee for ACLU National in assisting in the Wounded Knee trials. And you may remember, you know, we presented the motions in the trials when they brought all of those people to trial for charging them with shooting back at the military troops that were attacking them. And we ended up getting all of those charges dismissed by a federal district court judge against all of the members of the Native American community, the American Indian Movement, on the grounds that they were being unlawfully treated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the military, and that they were being criminally prosecuted by lying and cheating and the fabrication of evidence and everything against them. So that conduct had continued right up until, you know, 1973 and 1974, but it was the first time that I had ever gotten a direct up-close look at it. So I ended up eventually, among the various things that I've done that we've talked about on the show a number of times, I ended up becoming legal counsel for the Native American Rights Committee. And so I ended up working with the Native American people and have now upon occasion represented all nine of the Lakota tribes in South Dakota that make up the Ochati Sakowan Oyati, which is the council, the seven council fires of the people, and so that we are just getting ready to tomorrow morning receive a court order from Judge Viken of the United States District Court in South Dakota. He's going to be entering a final order declaring completely unconstitutional the process by means of which the state of South Dakota has been seizing and removing Native American children from their families and placing them in white boarding schools and in the custody of white people and the Department of Social Services. And they've been doing this now for, there was a whole period of 10 years that started immediately after George W. Bush became president in 2001. And it continued all the way into the first 2 years of the Obama administration, pursuant to which they were taking 742 Lakota children a year away from their parents and placing them in the South Dakota Children's Home Services Incorporated, which turned out to be
what did the children do?
The children hadn't done anything. What they were doing is that they were declaring the children as being neglected, because the Native American tribes in South Dakota, the nine reservations, have been set up by the United States government, and it turns out of the 3,320 counties in the entire United States, if you take the 11 poorest counties in the entire United States, seven of them are on the reservations in the state of South Dakota, and they have an 83% level of adult onset diabetes. And they live in abject poverty because the United States government took all of their land away. 90 million acres of land they removed from the Native people simply because they didn't want the gold rush people coming through all of their land slaughtering their buffalo and leaving them lying rotting on the sides of the road and dumping all their bedpans out on the road and destroying their hunting grounds. And they reached out to the American government and asked for them to send in people to protect them against these people. And the United States refused. And so Red Cloud helped lead a band of Ogallala Sioux and Nonpapa under Sitting Bull against the wagon trains to push them back out of their property. And so the United States government ended up sending in U.S. military forces and attacked them. And that's how the treaty that you referred to, the first treaty of 1851 at Fort Laramie, it set up a treaty explicitly acknowledging that all this trouble had been going on the western side of the Missouri River, because it was there that the Ogallala and the Umpapa, who are the more warlike of the seven council fires, were actually taking up arms against the wagon trains to force them to stay on the other side of the river. And they signed the Treaty of 1851, in which the United States government agreed that it would not allow the wagon train people to go into the west side of the Missouri River. And then they came back to Washington, D.C., and the American government and Congress interpreted that as saying that the complete lie, saying that the officials of the Lakota Nation had ceded all of their territory east of the Missouri River to the United States government. and so then they sent in military troops and seized all of the land east of the Missouri River. And so the people wouldn't stand for that, and so that they took up arms against them, and they sent in more United States military against them. And that was, and then they had a huge fight, and the Native American people ended up wiping out the military, a U.S. military, including Custer. That was the whole historical event of the wiping out of Custer's army. And the United States pleaded for a treaty, and in 1864, they signed the Second Treaty of Fort Laramie. And they agreed by treaty, acknowledging the possession of all of the land of the Lakota people, and it wasn't 4 years before they violated it again. And they sent in gold explorers into the Black Hills, and they issued a unilateral declaration on the part of the United States government that they were seizing the Black Hills because it had gold in the Black Hills. And they started sending in prospectors and white people into the hills. It's the most sacred territory of the Lakota people, that their whole creation story is that they, in fact, came up out of the ground in the wind caves, in this vortex of wind that comes up out of the ground in the Black Hills in the wind caves, and they came up out of those caves onto the prairie, and the United States government seized the Black Hills to subject them to mining by huge mining corporations, and in poisoning the rivers with arsenic, and to this day they hold the land. And the American Civil Liberties Union, we brought on a major case in the United States Supreme Court on behalf of the Lakota people, the people of the Seven Council Fires. And we won the case in the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court ruled that the seizure and taking of the Black Hills was absolutely, totally contrary to the Treaty of Fort Laramie. And then the Supreme Court, made up of course all white judges, said, "How much do you want for it?" And the people said, "We don't want anything for it. We want our land back." And the court said, "Oh, that's not how this goes. That's not how this goes. You know, they took the land, and it was completely unlawful for them to take it and all that. But now, you know, how much money do you want for it?" And the people said, absolutely, yeah, they weren't going to accept that. And finally, the court just said unilaterally they were going to put into an escrow account. You know, they printed they printed up several million dollars in new Federal Reserve notes and put them into an escrow account and said, okay, we'll hold this money for you then. Yeah, but the land still now belongs to the United States government. I mean, it's this kind of treatment. And then, you know, they send in these commodities to the Lakota families. I was sitting in Joe Cross's house, you know, out in Wombley, out on the far end of the Pine Ridge Reservation, and they picked up their rations that they were given by the United States government. They opened up the box and they had two huge Hershey chocolate bars and a gigantic bottle of Coca-Cola and these bright red nitrate hot dogs. You know, I mean, this is just like putting smallpox on the blankets and sending them into to the people, you know, and that is what has generated an 83% rate of adult onset diabetes, the worst in the entire world, actually, right there.
Danny,
and, you know, Danny, they have the highest.
Danny, I want to come back. Danny, I want to come back for a moment to something you said earlier that I want to go into greater depth on. I do not believe that the governor of the state or any other public health official could find any legal justification for taking over 7,000 children over a 10-year period from their parents unless the pharmaceutical industry's hand was somewhere in there. I'm betting, I could be wrong, but I'm betting that they were drugged, every single one of them. What is the case that you haven't yet spoke about this action that's going to be resolved tomorrow in court? And what about those 7,000 children? Since there was no legitimate reason for them to take it, there must have been some stipend given to the state. That's generally how it works. It's also in school systems. If you diagnose enough kids with ADD or ADHD, then the school gets so much money for that. So was there a kickback between the state taking these children, illegally taking these children, giving some bogus excuse, and then the federal government giving that state money in return?
Yes, that's exactly how it happened. What George W. Bush did when he was governor of the state of Texas from 1996 to the year 2000, before he became president, that what he did is he was the first governor in the entire history of the United States to declare that as a condition precedent for any child to be taken into the state foster care system in the state of Texas, they had to have a mandatory mental health examination, a screening exam. And so what he did is they drafted up the Texas Mental Health Algorithm Project. They created this project. They drafted up a test to be administered to children. And it turns out George W. Bush had the Eli Lilly Corporation draft up the Texas Mental Health Algorithm Test. What they did is they had a whole series of questions that were on the test that were all symptom-specific to a particular pharmaceutical that the Eli Lilly Company produced. And when this test was administered to the children in the state of Texas, 65% of the minority children that were administered this test would flunk the test, and that they would answer these questions, quote, incorrectly, which meant that they could be helped by having a particular pharmaceutical that the Eli Lilly Company happened to produce. Well, it turns out that 95% of the Native Americans that were given the test would flunk the test. And so what George Bush did is had his Department of Social Services and declare all of those children to be, quote, special needs children. And a peculiar thing happened in 1997. Hillary Clinton, then the first lady, during the second administration of Bill Clinton, that she joined together with Tom DeLay, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, before he was thrown out of the Speaker position, that they joined together and they crafted together a thing called the Adoption and Safe Families Act. And this was an act that offered to give federal money to the states to finance the special treatment that children needed if they were having difficulty being adopted out from the foster care program into a permanent home. When a child would get out, would be sent out to a foster care home, and about 6 weeks later, they'd be sent back, and then they'd be sent out to another one, and they'd be sent back, and it was determined that they were, quote, special needs children. They needed assistance. So the federal program, co-authored by Hillary Clinton and Tom DeLay, passed a federal statute in 1997, in December of 1997. And then the administration out in Texas under George W. Bush started filing applications for all of these children that were flunking the Eli Lilly drafted test, the Texas Mental Health Algorithm Project, and they started sending in applications for federal money in up to $79,000 per year per child started flowing into the state of Texas. And it came into the Department of Social Services, and over half of that money was being paid out to the Eli Lilly Corporation to pay for pharmaceutical drugs to administer to those children. And what happened is so much money was coming into the Eli Lilly Corporation from the state of Texas that the Eli Lilly Corporation gave bonuses to the mid-level officials in the Eli Lilly company that were responsible for administering the program in Texas. And then the CEO of the Eli Lilly Corporation went around and had those middle-level members of the Eli Lilly Corporation give voluntary campaign contributions to George W. Bush's presidential campaign. And so when he ended up being made president, as we recall, by the Supreme Court, one of the very first things that he did when he arrived in Washington, D.C., George W. Bush created a blue ribbon panel, which he handpicked the members of, and asked them whether or not he should impose as a condition precedent for sending any money from the Adoption and Safe Families Act in the federal government to any state in the country, that they had to adopt the Texas Mental Health Algorithm Project and administer that screening test to all of the kids. But the very first state in the entire country to copy what was done in Texas, was the state of South Dakota. Because W. Bush got to be close friends with William Janklow, who was the governor of the state of South Dakota, who was one of these good old boys that W. met at the annual governor's conferences, and he got to be good friends with Janklow. So he told Janklow about this, actually, when Janklow was invited to come to the inauguration in Washington, D.C. for W., pulled him aside, told him about this particular program and what a gold mine it would be because of all the Native American kids that were in South Dakota. That, you know, that there's 71,000 Native American people in the state of South Dakota that only has a population of 710,000 people. And so the Bush said, look, you got a gold mine here, a cottage industry to do. So William Janklow came back from Washington, and he was the very first one, before any Blue Ribbon Commission was even appointed, he adopted the Texas Mental Health Algorithm Project. And he therefore then started ordering his Department of Social Services to scoop up Native American kids under any pretense that they could, and draw them, take them away from their family, and they started using an emergency procedure that was a tiny part of the Indian Child Welfare Act that was passed in 1978 following the Wounded Knee occupations. And by the way, William Janklow, who was the governor who did this, was the chief assistant attorney general of the state of South Dakota, who called in the Nixon administration at the Wounded Knee occupation back in 1973. And here he is now in the year 2000. He's the governor of South Dakota, and he starts having all these children taken away from their parents and brought into when they seize them under this little provision, which is an emergency provision. If a child is found to be in immediate and in unavoidable danger of being seriously injured, they have a right under the Indian Child Welfare Act to take the child into temporary custody and then have a full set of hearings afterwards. But they were using just the preliminary hearing, and they'd take them, they'd have a perfunctory hearing where the parents were not even allowed to defend themselves, were not even allowed to put in any evidence to show that there was nothing wrong with what they were doing. And the children, that 98% of the kids were being taken for, quote, neglect. Not for any kind of abuse, not for any kind of wrongdoing on the part of the parent, but simply for neglect because they were so poor. And they would take the children and take them into custody, and they would send them to a place called the South Dakota Children's Home Services Incorporated, which turns out to have been a private, for-profit corporation that was run by Dennis Dugard, who was the lieutenant governor under Jank Law. And he, in his private capacity, ran this place, and they were getting all the federal money was going into them, and they actually converted that center into a psychiatric clinic. So the children were taken directly to a psychiatric clinic, because, and then they were administered the Texas Mental Health Algorithm test, which they flunked 95% of them, and then they started administering the drugs to them. And they would file the applications into the W. Bush administration for the $79,000 a year. They would send it to the state of South Dakota, and the state of South Dakota would then take half of it and give it to the pharmaceutical corporations, start drugging the children up, and then the other parts of the money was being, you're going to love this, the pharmaceutical companies that were making donations to the Republican National Committee. And that's how Tom Daschle, who was the majority leader for the United States Senate from South Dakota, that's how he was defeated for reelection. And the one single congressperson they had, she was defeated by the Republican Party. And that's how the Republican Party took over the entire state of South Dakota, making it the most Republican state in the entire country. Now, this is how this thing happened, and now we brought this case in front of the federal district court. Now, once the Obama administration came into power, and that we brought the action, and Judge Viken is going to be entering the order tomorrow morning. He's going to enter the order declaring the seizure of these children to have been not only a violation of the Indian Child Welfare Act statutorily, but in fact a conscious violation of the constitutional rights to due process of law of the parents that were losing their children. And he's going to enter an order mandating them following a set of procedures. And I believe that what he's going to do is he's going to mandate that they follow the brand new federal regulations that we have persuaded our Lakota People's Law Office in South Dakota, working directly with all nine of the tribes in South Dakota. They're all one tribe, but they're all these nine reservations. We actually got the Justice Department to issue an aggressive set with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, an aggressive set of rules and regulations as to what had to be done by all 50 states in the country to obey the 1978 Indian Child Welfare Act that was passed by United States Congress right after all the hoo-ha about the occupation of Wounded Knee, the 1975 killing of the two FBI agents in South Dakota, all of that turmoil. In 1976, the United States Senate appointed an American Indian Policy Review Commission chaired by Senator Jim Aberesk, who's the chairman of our board of directors of the Lakota People's Law Office. And he headed up that commission, and they were horrified at what they discovered. When they went around the country interviewing Native American people, they discovered that there was a wholesale taking of Native American children and putting them into these group homes, just like the Indian boarding schools, that the very thing that had been outlawed finally in the 20th century, that they were doing it again. The states were all engaged in this process of taking the children and putting them into these foster care homes. And that's what is going to be dealt with tomorrow morning. They're going to issue that order.
Okay, Danny, I want to focus on a few other issues. And congratulations for you and the other people who have finally brought this to where there will be some resolution, and that way the Indian children will no longer be able to be kidnapped, because it's really kidnapping by the state, state-sanctioned kidnapping. I want to go to something you just mentioned that is just never discussed today, certainly not in the mainstream media, and that is Leonard Pelletier. He was a Native American activist, a member of the American Indian Movement. He was sentenced to 2 life terms in prison for the alleged murder of 2 FBI agents at the 1975 armed standoff at Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Now, many people thought that Bill Clinton would give him a pardon. After all, Clinton pardoned Mark Rich, and who was a terrible human being, but after millions of dollars went to him, and now he didn't do it. So what is the likelihood that Obama might do it in a lame duck after the election? He could. But first, a lot of us investigating this saw that you could drive a truck through the discrepancies in the FBI report. Could you reveal to our audience why you believe, as I believe, that Leonard Pelletier was innocent and he was set up, and why this is a grave misjustice?
Matter is, it is acknowledged now that the FBI had no evidence to link Pelletier to the killing of these two FBI agents. All they ended up doing is acknowledging that he was one of some 40 members of the American Indian Movement who defended themselves when the FBI came pouring in to the Jumping Bull Camp, you know, back in 1975, you know, and then June 26, 1975, these two FBI agents, Ron Williams and Jack Culler, just came rolling on in, guns out and everything, into this jumping camp, looking for a young, you're going to love this, that their alleged excuse was they were looking for a young man who was alleged to have stolen a pair of cowboy boots at a party the previous night, that someone had left the cowboy boots sitting in the hallway, and he had allegedly stolen these cowboy boots, which it wasn't true. And so that they said they came onto the Jumping Bull campsite because they were looking for this guy, FBI agents, looking for this young fellow who allegedly had stolen a pair of cowboy boots. And what they did is they came in, guns drawn, and they fired upon the people that were there. And you don't fire on the American Indian Movement, and they did. And so like some 40 members of the American Indian Movement opened fire on these guys, and they were shot. And then they called in military support, and there was a huge shootout that went on. And these two guys, Ron Williams and Jack Culler, were killed. And what happened is the FBI ended up arresting charging three people with this, Robert Ribadeau and Daryl Butler and Pelletier. And the fact is, both Robert Ribadeau and Daryl Butler were charged and were tried, and they moved to get a change of venue out of this completely racist, white-dominated territory, in North Dakota and South Dakota. They went over to Iowa, and they had a federal trial, and they were all acquitted on the grounds of self-defense. But Pelletier didn't trust the court system, so he had gone up to Canada to get away. And what they did is they fabricated, the FBI and the Justice Department fabricated an entirely false report. In 1975, before Carter was elected, right? So this is under Gerald Ford. They end up completely falsifying an affidavit from this person, Myrtle Porbear, who asserted in her affidavit she was the girlfriend of Pelletier, and she'd been present at the shooting and saw Pelletier walk over and shoot both of these FBI guys in the head with his rifle. All right. Now, it turns out he never even met her, and everybody knew that she didn't know him. She had never been there at the shooting at all. She signed this thing, and then she later signed an affidavit saying she'd been threatened by the FBI to have to sign this. But they used it as a basis for extraditing him from Canada, brought him down, and put him on trial in North Dakota. You know, and in front of a judge appointed by Richard Nixon, this Paul Benson, and they put on all this evidence, and they acknowledged finally that they didn't have any real evidence. They never even called her to testify. What they did is they put on the evidence that all they could show is that Pelletier was one of 40 people that was in the site fighting back against these FBI people who ended up surrounding them. And they actually made the argument that, look, all they had to prove is that he had shot even one shot in the direction of these people and that he was therefore guilty of felony murder, of being involved in the shooting that resulted in their death. And that's how they convicted him. And they put him in jail. He's been in jail for 30 years now. For a crime he did not commit, and that they're perfectly aware of the fact that they explicitly acknowledged in the court that they could not prove in any way that he personally had fired on these particular guys. And in fact, they falsified a ballistics report saying that they found a spent cartridge shell near the body of the two FBI agents. They lied and fabricated the evidence, saying that it was from a rifle that had been connected to Pelletier. There was a full set of ballistic tests on the rifle that proved that it was not that casing did not come from his rifle, and they suppressed it and they concealed it. They promised that they had given over all of the documents the FBI had on the investigation of the shooting scene, and the fact of the matter is they withheld 140,000 documents from their investigation, from the trial. And in fact, the Court of Appeals judge, and the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals judge who wrote the opinion, Judge Hersey, who signed the denial of his appeal, has explicitly stated that the FBI used completely illegal tactics to convict him, and that the FBI was equally responsible for the shootout. And then he said, in fact, there's a real possibility that if any jury had been shown the evidence that was improperly withheld by the Justice Department of the Ford administration, that the jury might well have acquitted Pelletier, but they still refused to reverse the conviction, saying that he had been unable to prove that he did not do it because he didn't testify. You know, I mean, this is the bizarre state of affairs of the case that's holding Pelletier in, so that people should send the telegrams into Obama to demand that he pardon him for this. You know, and they're going to do it. Robert Redford and the other
people. I would
people,
definitely
Jack
recommend
Hillen,
it.
Former head of the other television ads and
Danny
stuff calling.
Danny, we're up to the end of the program. I just want to emphasize a few things. This is just the beginning of what I hope will be a series of exposés now that you and your legal team have won for the Native Americans of South Dakota and Lakota Nation the opportunity for children not to be kidnapped, that the pharmaceutical industry was a part of this. George Bush was the progenitor of this. It was all about greed. It was all about money, $79,000 per kid. But let us put this for a moment in a larger context. When you look at the five acts considered genocide in the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Crime of Genocide, it is very clear that the Native Americans fall within this because historically they have endured torture, concentrated act of terror, sexual abuse, massacres involving women, children, and elderly, systematic military occupations, removal of indigenous people from their ancestral territories, forced removal of Native American children to military-like boarding schools, and policies of termination. In fact, during Andrew Jackson's forced removal from lands, and Civil War and post-Civil War Indian Wars in the Southwest Great Plains, this all occurred. And the compulsory boarding schools from 1870s through 1960s started with Carlisle Boarding School, founded by U.S. Army officer Richard Pratt in 1879, that became the model for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And it was interesting because, as you said earlier in our conversation, and this actually came from Andrew Jackson, where he said, kill the Indian in him and save the man. And General Sherman, who is such a deplorable person, in 1873 said, we must act with vindictive earnestness against the Sioux, even to exterminate men, women, and children. During an assault, the soldiers cannot pause to distinguish between male and female or even discriminate as to age. So now we take a look back, and we see that we have always had this manifest destiny against the Indian. They have never been honored in 500 treaties. We've stolen their children. We've taken their children away, as you said, cut their hair, and forced them to unlearn what their native culture. Then we take them and put them in the most desolate and frequently the worst environments, and we then support them, as you said, with Coca-Cola and Hershey bars and hot dogs.
And nitrate hot
dogs.
And
then we wonder, why do they have depression, suicide, as you mentioned? Yeah, a suicide at the highest level.
Yeah.
By the way, even Ayn Rand supported genocide of Native Americans. So I think you've laid out a very important review. And so we will hope that all goes well. Please come back and give us more enlightenment on the outcome tomorrow of your hearing and your ruling in the court.
I'll be happy
once and for all, because free the Native Americans' children. And let's hear from you after that so we can talk about it, all right?
Absolutely. Have people just check, Gary.
We appreciate you being with us once again.
Lakotalaw.org. Lakotalaw.org on our Lakota People's Law Office.
All right. Danny Sheehan from Santa Cruz, California, thanks again for being with us, and thank you for helping the Native American peoples find justice. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you for listening.